furore about assessment in history. And this paper, which has the assessment of national curriculum history, a factual background report. Which I would have prepared for the committee. NFER formal trials in 65 schools, further trials held in 25 schools, and as a result the materials were submitted to the council. Work was steered by SEAC staff, took advice from a review group which included HMI, Welsh HMI, NCC, CCW, and members of SEAC's History Committee.
CCW, what was that?
Curriculum Council for Wales.
Oh, so, yeah. That's why I didn't know it.
National Curriculum History Orders. There was history orders in England and history orders in Wales, so we had to produce a set of SATs for Wales and a set of SATs for England. And, I can't remember now whether they were for England and Wales. And then this describes them. It was submitted to McGregor and it was approved. Tasworth distributed schools in January 1993. But this advice questioned whether in fact we should go on doing it. This was an incident I'll talk of in the context of Deering Review.
Would it be possible to take a copy of that?
Yeah.
It would be really helpful.
I can do a copy of that for you.
Thank you.
So yes, those went out. They were very much within the context of the kind of early SATs for Key Stage 1, which were often activity based. The infamous sinking and I probably don't remember, there was a science one which involved kids putting something in water to see whether it sank or float. The issue is, by the time you get to the 30th kid, is it an experiment or is it just a recall exercise?
No, that's difficult, isn't it? But these were all pen and paper ones.
Yeah, well they, and some of them you can still see reflected in a lot of what happens in primary history now. So, for example, telling the story of the Fire of London and drawing it, you'll probably find still going on. So there was history through stories and drawing it. There we are. This is Gunpowder Plot is the other one that we had. Fire of London was another one, all of which were mentioned in the history order. So this one was, which is this one? Oh, this was trying to suggest reasons why people did things. So it was bubbles. Can you get kids to... I can remember having a very interesting session with some teachers where we were talking about this, is it real or is it fictional? And this teacher said, are you telling me that I've got to tell my 7-year-olds that Father Christmas isn't real? And, it was difficult times. It was, but, and the photographs, I thought, I mean, this was some of the best work we ever did with the photograph. And getting them to really look closely at the pictures, and then you could link this into history through objects by showing them a flat iron and this sort of thing. And
great photographs. A lot of trouble must have been taken to find these specific photographs because there's so much in them. For instance, the fact that every child has met the same drawing, and this domestic scene.
And that was the great thing about NFER, I think, in developing them. This kind of shop scene. They also, were done with a view for looking at before and after as well. And the suggestion in the set about, find your own local photograph. Evacuees. Well.
And even the inclusion of black children as well.
That's merely a background. And that's the family sitting down to tea in the 1950s. Good. So I was very pleased with these, and now the reason they disappeared without trace was that in the summer of 1993, I think it was, Patton suddenly declared the unthinkable. You know, this national curriculum that people thought was set in stone and, you know, was the way of the future, was going to be changed.
Well, that was a reaction to the teachers' revolt over the SATs, wasn't it?
Particularly the English SATs.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, we trialled the Key Stage 3 history tests in the summer of 1993, and I think we only had 25 schools who were in the trial in the event because of the boycott of tests. Only two schools, and both of which were independent schools, took the test. So effectively, we didn't really have anything. Eric Evans wrote a wonderful report which said, you know, had I got any evidence, I could tell you something. But he went on, he managed to drag it out a bit longer than that. And the world changed. So the requirement for Key Stage 1 teachers to make a judgment on pupils' understanding of history at the age of 7 never really materialised. Key Stage 3 was due to come in 1994.
Mm.
Never did, because the curriculum was under review. And Key Stage 2 was due to come in 1995, and again never did, because curriculum... So the assessment for arrangements for history, and you forget about GCSE, because by this time they'd already taken the view that history wouldn't go on to... They'd already taken the view that it was either history or geography.
Mm.
I mean, that was one of the big compromises very early on.
Yeah.
But
in fact, they didn't have any prescribed curriculum for Key Stage 4.
Yes, they did.
Did they?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, that was just a threat to SHP, though, wasn't it? But SHP continued.
Well, because the Key Stage 4 curriculum was never implemented.
Oh, right.
But if you look in here...
Yes,
and it's quite interesting because the Key Stage 4 curriculum, programme study for Key Stage 4. Model 1 and Model 2. Have I got Model 1? Yeah. No, that's right.
That's 3, so...
So... that looks like... This is not called. Oh, there we are.
There
Model
it is,
one,
yeah.
Model 1 was one that was to be a full GCSE, and the other one was to be a half GCSE. And this was moving towards the possibility that there might be a half GCSE history, half GCSE geography.
Mm.
The amount of effort that went into all this at the time, looking back on it.
It's very brief, Key Stage 4. It's not a prescribed curriculum.
Yeah, there should be.
You've got these.
British Democracy,
yeah,
and International Conflict and Cooperation, yeah, mm-hmm. Economic, Social, Cultural Change, and I thought that there was a Modern World Study there as well.
So SHP could have fitted into it.
Yeah, that was the intention.
Anyway. General enough to allow them to sort of continue.
Thematic unit designed to deepen pupils' knowledge of chronology.
Yeah.
Drawn from British history, involves study over time, giving implicit attention to chronology. Where have you heard all this before?
Mm-hmm.
Compare developments in different periods. Parliament, public health, education, agriculture, work, migration, popular culture. So... SHP.
Public health one, yeah.
A unit involving a detailed study of 20th century history of a country or region of the world other than Britain, chosen from Russia, USA, India, Africa, Middle East.
China. Yeah. So it's there, isn't it? Yeah.
Focus on key historical issues, involve studying that. So, yeah, it's interesting that the working group, in trying to develop a Key Stage 4 programme study, was very much looking... to a certain extent at elements, but then not entirely SHP, because you've got a core unit which says the development of British democracy 1900 to the present day, which was finishing off, if you like, the British history that ran right the way through the and equally an international conflict, because the problem in 1995 was the curriculum was going to end at 14, So all this stuff that was in Key Stage 4
had to be brought in.
So we had to reduce the prescription but push more stuff into Key Stage 3. So it became...
Key Stage 3 had always had World War 2 in it, though. That was the follow-up to that, yeah.
And that interesting conflict and cooperation was trying to make a themed study as well. Based around war and peace and such things.
So, coming to 1993-4.
Well, 1993 started off... One of the things that's interesting about the middle of the early 1990s was when the right wing, represented by people like the Campaign for Real Education, suddenly realised that they'd missed a trick when the national curriculum was going through, and that this was a much more powerful tool than they'd realised, and they'd lost out. And so you can see in the pamphlets around 1992, 1993, a lot of Campaign for Real Education really comes into its own. It starts attacking all of the subjects, but history is one of the subjects in particular. It starts demonising the skills-based approach. And such like.
It's the Sheila Lawler background, isn't it? She wrote a big pamphlet on it, yeah.
But equally, you had a takeover of the Quangos. So, for example, Philip Halsey was sacked as head of SEAC, and Lord Griffiths of Forest Farc became the chairman and chief executive. And in NCC... Duncan Graham went, and I can't off the hand remember who replaced him, but either way it was another right wing chairman brought in to control these Quangos. And for me, as the head of the history committee, or the person who serviced the history committee rather, the chairs of these committees were taken from the council, and people like Lord Skidelsky had been brought onto the council, Robert Skidelsky, and he became the head of the history committee. And he was adamant that history assessment was wrong. And so in early January, we had a working group in Eastbourne, of all places, where...
So it's January 1994?
January 1993. This is before Patton pulled the plug. To look at history and its assessment. And so that document that I've just shown you was a backing paper to this one. Which grew out of this committee meeting to look at history assessment. And what Skidelsky was after was, he had two particular things that worried him. One was the over-prescription of the national curriculum as he perceived it through local authority documentation. And he was absolutely right. What was happening throughout the country was that local authorities were taking the national curriculum, interpreting it to teachers, and adding into the national curriculum all sorts of requirements that suited their purposes.
Such as?
Well, they were producing big documents which were saying, this is how your syllabus has got to be. Whether this was true in history or not, I'm not sure, but certainly he would come in with, you know, the such and such local authority folder on history, which included schemes of work and things like that, all of which were being seen by some schools who were complaining to him as extra requirements. So one of the problems all along with national curriculum is the mythology of what is required, which is infinitely more than is actually required.
Yes, whether that's something that's just a characteristic of teachers anyway, or of the relationship between local authority teachers, but whenever there's an innovation, there's a sort of panic.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a reflection of the power relations in which teachers find themselves in schools and in relation to local authorities.
And they look to local experts to tell them what they should do. Yes. And those local experts, when they say, well, this is how you could do it, that becomes, this is how you should do it. And so. But the other big things that Skidelsky was opposed to was statements of attainment and the idea of a 10-level scale.
He wanted a knowledge-based
It's not fair to say that he wanted a knowledge-based assessment. He didn't believe that you could teach history to primary children. So, you know, there was certain points obviously, but he could understand that history was about cause and consequence, yeah, and such like. He also, you know, fully understood that history was about sources, although he didn't believe that anybody under 16 could really understand the source. Mm. Yeah, so had some fairly traditional perceptions. Mm. But he looked at these 10-level scales and said, this is nonsense. And so this working group, which, I mean, it's quite an interesting thing. The names of the working group were actually here, I noticed. Skidelsky chaired it, Eric Evans, Tony Freeman, as in Anthony Freeman, Chris McGovern.
Yeah.
The reason it was in Eastbourne, by the way, was because it was near to where two lived. Yeah. Paul Noble, Laurie Taylor.
Oh, Paul Noble is a primary school head teacher.
Exactly.
But I haven't managed to track him down.
Yeah. And then Tim Lomas.
Oh, Laurie Taylor, as in Radio 4, BBC, or a different one?
I can't think it's the Radio 4 one.
Professor Laurie Taylor. Mm.
Mm. Could be. I can't remember.
Yeah, but you don't have a contact for Paul Noble.
No. And Tim Lomas and Anne Lobia, who were members of the National Working Group. So it was a small group. And what this was arguing for was end of key stage descriptions. What this group ended up saying was that we'd be much better to have end of key stage descriptions than level description.
And that's what you've ended up with, actually, isn't it?
Well, you ended up with level descriptions, which aren't, or 8-level descriptions plus exceptional performance, which is what Deering brought in, but which aren't end of key stage descriptions. During the run-up to the National Curriculum Review in 1995, there was a big debate in SEAC about whether it should be statements of attainment and levels, which the mathematicians were quite happy with, because it's a maths-based system, based on, you know, whether it should be end of key stage statements, which a lot of us were in favour of, because it seemed to us that provided you with a way of seeing progression. You know, I mean, what I think you have to remember is that when I started teaching, I had no way of articulating progression. And if level descriptions or statements of attainment have done nothing else, it's provided a language. What's interesting is that it's how you go from a hypothesis to a reality. And that's in part what these SATs are about. And then there was the other people who were saying, well, you know, in between end of key stage statements and statements of attainment, there are these things called level descriptions.
Mm.
And the judgment was made during the review that statements of attainment, I mean, you know, the fact that you had 18 attainment targets with 10 statements of attainment in some subjects was bizarre. The idea of going for one attainment target and having an amalgamated level description was decided as the way forward for all subjects. And then what we had to do was go away and say, well, if we wanted end of key stage statement, what would end of key stage statements look like? And can we then work from there to that? And level descriptions in history began their life underneath our feet in the basement, where Sue Bennett, John Hamer and myself spent a day on Christmas going from statements of attainment to end of key stage statements to level descriptions and produced the first drafts of the level description. But they were never anything more than, you know, well, let's see if we can find meaningful distinctions between this and that. You know, in mark schemes, I was always very critical of something which said, level one is this, level two is this plus a bit more, and level three is this plus a bit more and a bit more. So, you know, you had to make a step change and you had to be discrete. So, and the interesting thing about the SATs and the exemplification work was it was an attempt to try and show what these theoretical statements meant in practice. And it's quite interesting. I've just been trying to find this morning National Curriculum in Action. I don't know whether you ever saw it or ever used it. But in 1993, we produced Consistency in Teacher Assessment at Key Stage 3, which was teacher assessment was always going to happen, but it wasn't going to be statutory and it wasn't going to be regulated. But you nevertheless had to give teachers some way of making judgments about what is level 7 in history or what is statement of attainment. And we produced exemplification. Key stage 1 SATs are exemplification in the sense that they show examples of what the answers would be. So we produced this in 1993. This was effectively saying, you know, it's all about professional judgment, it's down to you, you find evidence, etc. All the positive messages about it, and trying to play down the whole business of keeping records, which, you know, teachers now would still say is the bane of national curriculum assessment because of schemes that schools have adopted that every department's got to follow. And, you know, if you look through teaching history, you can see the complaints about recording schemes being imposed on history departments. Yeah. But then you start creating these. This was 1993, and this was an attempt to say, this is what the level description is. This is attainment targets of statements of attainment. So this was linking to the programmes of study, and it was trying to show what work would look like. Now, the background to this booklet. Lord Griffiths' Forex Fark. I don't want any work in exemplification showing any errors or any teacher marking.
Oh, goodness.
Right?
Yeah.
So this lost. This had no credibility when he went out, because I mean, you just look at it and you say, "Is this really normal work?
Yeah.
Is this
no crossings out?"
Nothing. And we had to edit. I mean, you can imagine you couldn't find work like this.
How did you do it?
Well, we had to, you know, tip X out changes, and you can see it a bit.
You can, yeah. Did you get the children to rewrite little bits?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah,
but it was
silly, man.
Yeah, and it was even worse in this one. This was children's work assessed in history and geography. This was key stage 1. And we got away with some crossings out in this, I noticed, but we had one piece of work.
This has got inserts in.
But, I mean, teachers looked at that and said, you know, which kids do you ever see? This is quite nice. This is Louise's timeline.
Oh, that is nice, isn't it? That's lovely as well. Having said that, we've had examples sent to us of really lovely work that, you know, people have kept from when they were at school. Robin Hood.
And we actually, that's a conversation. Again, you're showing types of work. We were starting to get word process work in those days as well, which is quite interesting. That's geography, yes. But then this one.
That one as well, that's a word process.
This was second generation of children's work assessed. That was first national curriculum. This was post Deering. And we were producing it in a much more liberal environment, if you like, although this was still under, this was Gillian Shepherd, the Secretary of State, probably for my money one of the best Secretaries of State, because she just let the Quangos get on with doing what they've been asked to do. But here we got corrections and teachers' comments, and this worked a lot better. And then what I did in 1996, I moved from doing history to being responsible for teacher assessment. So I was responsible for consistency in teacher assessment, the whole series. So I was not just doing history. So we did these. And then post the 2000 curriculum, when we changed the level descriptions a bit, we decided we'd have National Curriculum Action, but we would put it online. And National Curriculum Action was exemplification of pupils' work on screen. And it meant we could put video up, and it meant we could put such like. And
was that when you were down to one attainment target?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I noticed today that I couldn't get into it. So it could well be one of the number of websites that has been hacked. Why? Yeah. We're slowly drowning in books in here.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's been... it's linked to QCDA going down, isn't it? Lots of things that seem to have gone to the nuisance, of course, as well. Somebody will have them, and there is a... Kate sent an email out.
National Archives.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm hoping that's it. But anyway, so going back to where we were, January 1993, you got the start of this backlash, which was really questioning a lot of the tenets of the national curriculum. So it wasn't all that much of a surprise when in the summer of 1993, James Patton said, I'm going to appoint this man from the post office to review the national curriculum. Deering, I mean, I've got a wonderful cartoon which shows this... dilapidated house with lots of additions on it, overgrown and this sort of thing. John Patton looking out of the cartoon, saying to this character who all you can see is the back of his head, is, you know, just what you want, Lord Deering, or Deering as he was then, you know, just a new lick of paint or whatever and it'll be as good as new. And the fact is, you know, this cartoon had no idea what Deering looked like. All he could do was show the back of his cartoon.
Yeah, sounds like Steve Bell that.
Yeah. So suddenly everything changed, and a lot of things that were in progress, like Key Stage 3 tests for history, like the Key Stage 1 SATs that were produced but never went out. The exemplification had gone out, but everything went on kind of hold, and we went into review mode again.
So when you were working with that committee, on McGovern was on it, etc., and you'd already worked with the Eastbourne group.
Mm.
Some of the issues that later divided them, were they just there from the beginning? Everybody was set in their own little camp, and you know.
It was quite interesting because Nick, by that time, was a senior manager within SCAR, and he took it on himself, I think, to manage some of the more extreme right-wing elements of that group. So that the tensions were there, but they didn't necessarily articulate themselves in discussion.
Because given what Chris McGovern wrote afterwards, you don't expect that he'd be in there saying, come on, I want more on Elizabeth I, or, you know.
Well, we tended to do a fair bit in kind of subgroups because you were looking to revise the primary curriculum and the secondary curriculum. You were looking to develop a Key Stage 3 curriculum that reflected the fact there wasn't a Key Stage 4 curriculum anymore, and so on. Yeah. So there was a lot of technical work there. So we didn't always keep them as a big group all the time. We tended to work in subgroups quite a lot.
So that was a given before you started, is that Deering said, we're going to stop having a compulsory history or geography, that's it, it's going.
It became a given as we were working through. I don't think in 1993 it was definitely a given, but I think by the time we got to his proposals, it was that 8-level scale instead of a 10-level scale. And in those subjects that are optional post-Key Stage 3, there will be no national curriculum at Key Stage 4. So... and then the issue was which subjects were going to, so part of the review became which of the subjects will become optional in Key Stage, at the end of Key Stage 3. And in that sense, I mean, what came out of the review was just a reversion back to what had been status quo in many schools pre the national curriculum. And, you know, what many people failed to recognise is that, you know, whatever the national curriculum said about Key Stage 4, it never happened because it was always due to come into effect after Key Stage 3 had been implemented anyway. So, you know, history has never been statutory at Key Stage 4, even though there are programmes of study for it. And for that matter, there were GCSE criteria written for history which reflected the national curriculum programmes of study, and there were syllabuses produced and approved, but of course, again, never saw the light of day because, you know, another several thousand pounds. I can remember sitting down with some committees and, you know, sitting there and saying, you know, I know that you will want history to remain compulsory post 14, but that is no longer debatable.
So the Deering Review Committee had a series of meetings over the summer of
ran from the summer of 1993 through to the early part of 1994 was general consultation,
right,
if I remember rightly. Deering made a point of going around the country and talking to head teachers.
Mm.
And he'd stand there and say, look, I don't know anything about the curriculum, you tell me.
Which he didn't, did he? Yeah.
But he was very good at summing up their views. Mm. And he was wonderful to work. And I think it must have been in 1994 that we set up the subject committee. But it was only after his interim report where he'd started to lay down the ways things were going to go.
And that was just from picking up the on-the-ground views.
Yeah. And I think at the time it was the biggest consultation that had ever been carried out. Mm. And this has got to be set against the context of the consultation on the national curriculum, the concept of the national curriculum in 1988, the Red Book, which generated lots of heat but produced no light because nobody took any notice of the consultation responses. You know, they knew what they were going to do and they went ahead and did it.
Mm.
When I'm telling the story of the national curriculum, often to international audience, this is the point where we started the fight back in terms of winning hearts and minds, where, you know, the given was that there will be a national curriculum. And by 1994, most people accepted the fact that a national curriculum was a good thing.
Mm.
The issue was, what national curriculum? We had lots of we attended, Sue and I would go to historical association conferences, we'd go to local authority conferences up and down the country. We got lots and lots of letters from all sorts of lobby groups. I've got to be careful because consultations merge one to another. So, you know, I went through all this again in 1999. So, you know, whether this was the one where we got the letter from the organisation for the preservation of English trees and wanting a history curriculum based around trees and the role of the tree in the development of England. It's a very, you think about it, ships, hearts of oak and all that.
Simon Sharma did a point of view on Radio 4 on the oak tree the other day, about the role of the oak tree in British history. All those consultation responses will be, any idea?
Good question. What, on the 1994 curriculum? I suspect that they would have been lost along with all the other stuff which happened when SCAR moved to QCA, I guess. When SCAR moved to QCA from Notting Gate to Piccadilly, we were told that we had to lose a third of paperwork and... SCAR had a wonderful library that was broken up, and so one of the problems of emulgation, and as you're seeing with the closure of QCDA, you know, we're finding that stuff on the web is even more bothable than printed stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can't remember what happened to the consultation responses. I know there's the consultation report I've got.
Oh, that would be interesting to look at.
That was the document I just brought in. Now, where's it gone?
We're already drowning in a sea of documents.
We are, aren't we? That's a draft proposal. So that was that. Those draft proposals. Right. So, aim of review, statements to level descriptions. That, in part, was standard text. This, I guess, would be our attempt to sum up what we'd done in the light of the consultation.
Yeah, because there was a requirement that you reduce the content, wasn't there?
Restructuring, progression.
Mm.
Introduction of key elements. And a move to a single attainment target.
Yeah. So, one of the key things that the group had to do when it was set up early 1994 was reduced content.
Yeah.
And one would expect that would be a really contentious area, given these right-wing elements in the group. Was that the case?
So, well, it was a question of which bits of content you're going to cut out, which bits of content you're going to keep in.
Mm.
And then, you see, the question that was never of issue is, can you put new content in?
Yeah.
It was always, I mean, in fact, in every review, it's always been a case of how do you go from what the original working group did and what was in the original National Curriculum, how do you work down from that? So always there has been the question of, can you go back and change what the original National Curriculum said, to which the answer has always been no.
No.
And that, of course, was McGovern's major problem, because he, you know, I wouldn't start from here.
Mm.
And...
But that was Patton or Deering who decided, no, we're not going to have reshifting completely.
It was this issue of how do you ensure continuity. I mean, in part, this review was about easing teachers' workload.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the mantra in every review, wasn't it? And therefore, it's about making it... reducing content, making it clearer, cutting out those things that were seen as... it was quite interesting. One of the things about Deering was cutting out those things from the orders which were seen as trying to impose on teachers a way of teaching as opposed to telling them what to teach. So, in many ways, Deering was about trying to get back to the essentials of setting out the how and the why. Well, setting out the how, but not the way, not the what. And the other thing about Deering, I think, that we did was to try and be much clearer about the why. And certainly when we did the review in 2000, we had a much greater emphasis on the why. So the curriculum in 2000 is the first one which has a two-page aims statement.
Yeah.
And where every subject has a statement of aims at the beginning of it. And the great irony, of course, is that in the history, in the first national curriculum, the aims for the history national curriculum are in that document, which are the final proposals of the working group, which of course never saw their way into what teachers got. And so this is the tragedy of this national curriculum, in the sense that all this lot, all the introduction, all the explanation, all the kind of thinking through, all the rationale, never saw the light of day. And that's, again, you know, when you're looking at implementing change, helping teachers understand why they're being asked to do what they're being asked to do, is key, but was not what happened in 1991, and it wasn't what happened in 1995, even to a certain extent. What happened after 1995 to me was I then became, as I said, part of a review team. You know, Deering said there'll be no more changes for 5 years.
Yeah.
Well, SCAR set up a curriculum review team in 1996 with the job of reviewing the national curriculum over that five-year period and coming up with a decision about whether it needed to be changed in 2000. And there were 13 of us. And our job really was to monitor and evaluate the national curriculum. And it was the first time in this country that any body had set up a systematic evaluation of this national curriculum. Now, it wasn't made easier by a change of government in the middle of 1997, but, I mean, to give the Labour Party its due, you know, we expected, you know, our work to be kind of cut short. And there were some things, I mean, one of the first things the Labour Party did, for example, when it came in, was say it was going to suspend the foundation subjects at primary so that literacy and numeracy could. And, you know, that was... But they didn't stop us carrying out the review. They stuck to the timetable.
Yeah.
And they stuck to, I think, Charles Clarke, the Secretary of State then. Charles Clarke saying, you know, I'm quite happy to receive your advice in January of 1999 and so on. So for 5 years, we produced annual monitoring reports. And we went round and talked to teachers. And one of the things that we found was that, for example, a lot of the guidance that was produced to support this curriculum never got to teachers. I remember going to talk in a school down in Brighton about consistency in teacher assessment. And when I went to see the deputy head, and then I was going to go up and see the staff, and as we went, he said, excuse me, I'll just get these out of the cupboard. And he pulled out all these documents we'd sent to the school. And I said, oh, I'm glad you've got those. Well, that's my starting point. He said, I didn't think I'd show them to the staff until you came to talk to them. So it's kind of rewind.
Yeah.
And that's happened in a lot of schools, I think.
Do you think that because there was never any assessment of history, teachers just concentrated on delivering the content, especially at primary, using materials that obviously were available, without much attention to progression of levels?
Probably. I mean, Sue raised at the seminar the whole business about conceptualisation of history in a way that had not quite happened before. She would also argue that probably it was too clever for a lot of teachers, that it almost over-intellectualised the subject. And that interpretations, for example, was the kind of straw that broke the camel's back for some. I mean, if I had a pound for every time I've sat in a seminar trying to explain what 82 meant in the old curriculum and what interpretations of history meant. Mm. And you know, Tim Lomas has written War and Peace on what interpretation meant. You know. And I think, you know, people like Christine, who I have great respect for, but I mean, I got to a point where reading teaching history became so hard because it was really trying to so deconstruct what you were doing that you lost track of the fact that you're actually telling a story about the past.
Yeah, I have to say, that comes across to me is that once you focus too much on, I want to move them from one level of thinking to another, you lose your focus on the other things, which are all part and parcel of learning the history.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to do it.
I mean, every national curriculum always talks about the balance between applying their knowledge to their understanding. And I think it is that balance. But I think we've probably, over time, underestimated how difficult that is to do consciously. I think a lot of teachers do it subconsciously, and they do it very well subconsciously.
Mm.
But the minute you start to try and have to articulate it, and particularly when you start to try and set assessments where you're doing it, you have to become much more conscious about it, and that makes it harder. Mm. And, you know, you set against that the kind of reduction in time that people have for training to be teachers, and particularly on assessment, and you get a situation which I think compounds its own difficulty. Although that said, I think many history teachers have no problem whatsoever, and you know, the better ones.
Just going back to 1994, how did you react to Chris McGovern's minority report?
We had to write quite a long document, which. Is here. McGovern's Minority Report, a critique of McGovern's Minority Report. Because in many ways, what Chris was trying to do was to undermine Sue and I.
Oh, right.
In the sense that the Minority Report is quite critical, not only of what had been done, but the way it had been done.
Mm.
So part of it was a personal attack, although we tried not to take it personally, in the sense that whoever had been there, it would have been an attack on them. But it was significant. I mean, by that time, Chris Woodhead was chief executive. Chris, when he acted quickly, so therefore you had to get your defence in quickly. I noticed this was to Sir Ron, Chris Woodhead and Nick Tate.
Mm.
And so this was this reviewed the process and the advisory group.
So Chris Woodhead was chief executive of SCAR. Nick Tate
at this point was a senior manager.
Right.
Responsible, I think, for Key Stage 3. I mean, for example, just to give you an example, this one of the things, he implies that members lack the subject knowledge necessary to carry out the task. This was deliberately a group of practicing teachers looking at existing order and making professional decisions about what content should stay and what should go. Most members had history degrees and substantial teaching experience. their professionalism was best demonstrated. So, you know, it was an attack on a number of levels. It wasn't just about the content, it was about the people and such like. And so we had to knock these out. As I say, part of the problem with McGovern's report was that he wanted to, you know, not start from where we'd been told we had to start. So, you know, he was saying, well, you should never have accepted a brief that said you've got to start from the original working group report. But every working group had to start from the same brief. So.
Yeah.
In that sense, it was... Yeah, but
I did the same sort of slimming down of the attainment targets happen in other areas as well?
Every other subject. Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about the Deering Review was that we had two levels of committee. The original national curriculum was produced by subject working groups.
Yeah.
And there was no... because it was produced also in a phased way, English, maths, science, and then... other subject, there was no possibility to take any kind of overview of what the impact of this would be. And I mean, one argument about the collapse of the first national curriculum is that it's only when it was all in place that, you know, primary schools suddenly found themselves sinking under the weight of it.
Yeah.
So as well as the subject committees, the Deering Review also had a kind of primary group made up of primary heads, a secondary group made up of secondary heads. And the interesting thing was that we would go away and talk with our subject committees, and then we'd develop proposals, and then we'd come. We had to report to these secondary and primary groups, who would either, you know, say, "No, you can't have that. You can't do that.
Mm.
You've got to do this." So they were developing proposals. So it was a
It must have been great to be on that committee.
I know we used to have to appear between who was the. We had somebody for Key Stage 3, somebody for Key Stage 1, somebody for Key Stage 2, and somebody for Key Stage 3. There was a senior manager, and interestingly, they were all women. In fact, at the time, I think they were referred to as the Witches of Eastwick, reflecting the film. But going to present your findings to them was like going through a Star Chamber grilling, because, you know, the one was looking at it from Key Stage 1, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We had to negotiate all the findings and the level descriptions. And of course their job, as my job was in 1999, was to try and get some kind of coherence across all the subjects. So you're going in, this is good history, this is. And they're going, yes, but is it good curriculum? And do your level descriptions look like the level description in English? And do they? So there was a lot of that kind of working, if you like, to move the subjects into a much more whole whole school curriculum view, which is what I think made Deering much more acceptable to schools, because when it came out, it was seen as something that had coherence, whereas the other one, I mean, it was a set of, you know, bananas and oranges and things, and, you know, how do you put it all together?
And then the 1999 change, there's a bit more slimming down.
Yeah, there was more slimming down.
Yeah.
Jill Watson was the history officer by the time that went through. David Blunkett was the Secretary of State. But a lot of the negotiations were with his advisor, whose name I've forgotten. He resurfaced quite recently, post the election, and did a kind of comment on how things had changed. But dealing with Blunkett was quite interesting. Blunkett had his own views on what should be in the history order and what shouldn't, or particularly what examples should be in the history order.
Interesting. What did he particularly favour?
I'm trying
constitutional history?
No. It was much more down to individuals.
Labour heroes?
Not necessarily. One of the things that came out of the review was that there were, in the non-statutory examples, there were not enough women. And so Jill had gone out of her way to develop a much broader set of examples. And a lot of those examples were taken out in the kind of negotiations over the phone. But again, you know, at that point I was sitting on this group that was looking at the whole thing. And of course we were looking to develop a curriculum in 2000 that would be visually much more accessible and equally would have a much stronger rationale. So you had aims for the subjects for the first time. You had key stage statements saying what the history in that key stage was about, and those came very close to being end of key stage statements. And I still think, you know, the subject will be better off having key stage statements. And indeed, in the primary review, which is now dead, they almost came to having a kind of end of key stage, mid key stage two, mid key stage two statement, and so on. Primary heads could never understand how you could have eight levels which didn't match the years. So they said, why don't I have level one for year one, level two for year two, level three for year three, and so on? Why is it that level four is for year six, and then level five and six is for year nine?
Yeah.
You know, if it, level five and six is for year nine, what's the point of having level seven? So they, a lot of primary heads would say, why don't you just make the levels match the years? And it's the, you know, there was no rational argument which said, why don't you make the levels match the year? The fact was that we'd gone from 10 levels, which never matched any years, to 8 levels. And, you know, then there was the question of, is a level 1 in Key Stage 1 the same as a level 1 in Key Stage 3 and all that lot? And it struggled, you know. And yet has become, you know, my granddaughter, who's in year 8, comes home and says, oh, I'm 5C in my history. And you go, A, there's no such thing as C. Yeah. But then that's a hangover from national curriculum testing, where they do have A, B and C. National curriculum testing.
Oh, right.
Top level, middle level.
English and maths, yeah.
And therefore schools have put it into all subjects that you have a top level, middle level and bottom level. So even though there's no level description for History 5C, my granddaughter believes that she can be History 5C, and she's quite happy about being History 5C.
Oh, that's lovely.
So goodness, it's just, just as she's happy to be in year 8, whereas as far as I'm concerned she's still the second year.
So that's great. Thanks ever so much. I'm going to switch this off now.